Oh, hey there. I'm Guy Branum, and welcome to Pop Rocket, a weekly show peeking over all the pop culture we love to love. With me to talk TV, film, music, and anything else entertaining, our digital strategist, Winter Mitchell.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hello, Winter. What's going on?
Everything's fantastic.
Good. I'm glad.
I appreciate that.
We got journalist and novelist Margaret Wappler.
Hi there, Guy. I'm enjoying your floral dress wear tonight.
Thank you. It was very springy in L.A., and I decided I couldn't wear long pants. So I'm very floral. And we've got pop culture scholar and dyke about town, Karen Tongson.
Hey, Guy. Hi, Racketeers.
Karen, what's going on in your life?
Well, I was knocked out with some sort of terrible cold plague thing. Luckily, it wasn't the flu this weekend. So I had a chance to catch up a little bit with some things in popular culture and mostly just learned about all sorts of homeopathic remedies.
Oh, that's wonderful.
What's your favorite one?
I mean, turmeric everything.
Yes.
Oregano oil in like everything also. Which
Who would have imagined
you know?
That turmeric would have a moment?
Oh,
it's really
a
having an
moment.
Extended moment.
One of my favorite things.
Yeah. Coming up on this week's show, we're going to be talking about the line, "I will not let this nobody kill him again," and the TV movie that surrounds it. But mostly we're going to talk about that line. I, of course, mean The Assassination of Gianni Versace, American Crime Story, Season 2. Plus, we'll each be sharing our...
Season 1.
No, it's Season 2. OJ was Season 1.
Season 2.
Yes.
My bad.
Plus, we'll each be sharing our latest jams. But first, let's find out what arts and entertainment news or events have caught our attention this week. Karen Tongson, what are you all about this week?
So, wallowing in my feverish, in my fever dream and fever state, I happened upon the Hollywood Reporter article that just, you know, affirmed why I wanted Ellen Pompeo in my coven, even though she was ultimately kicked out by Maura Tierney. And it's a story on how she became the highest paid actress in a primetime TV drama ever.
Uh-huh.
So essentially, she's now the $20 million woman. She's making $575,000 per episode of Grey's Anatomy, along with some back-end stuff, you know, extra like six figures here and there, or seven figures, signing bonuses, etc. The thing that really struck me about this story, though, was how aware Ellen Pompeo is of her particular role in Hollywood as an actress, as someone, as a woman of her age, in terms of, like, you know, how young actresses will have their youth absorbed by the system and then just like be kind of abandoned.
Yeah.
Right. And she really sees herself as like, you know, look, people can be great at a role for like the first couple seasons and then phone it in. But like, I've been awesome for 14 years as Meredith Grey. Plus, I'm the title character. She gives us some insight on how they would leverage Patrick Dempsey's presence as a second lead to try to get her to back off from some of her demands. Shonda was the one, obviously, who sort of helped mentor her to ask for what she deserved. Anyway, it's a very instructive story, a very instructive tale. I love that one of the things she does is laments that the great Faye Dunaway drives a Prius and what a great injustice that is. And she says not that there's anything wrong with the Prius, but my point is she had no financial power.
Yeah.
So
I had no idea how savvy and forceful she was, or she is, rather.
Yeah.
I think that from some kind of aura about that show that I just have married her to her character, and I feel like her character is sort of a walking disaster all the time. And I think I just
well
put
now
that
she's
on
won
Ellen
the Harper
Pompeo.
Avery.
Oh,
but anyway, but
wait,
yeah,
what's the Harper Avery?
Well, it's a big surgery award.
Oh, good for her.
But,
you know, congratulations, Heather Gray.
But the thing
I think
about
nominations
her
for this year are coming out this week.
But the thing is, you know, she's also one of the things that lately has made itself apparent is that she's very much a kind of woke bae on Twitter. Like, she's super politically engaged and conscious. She takes on a lot of haters and trolls, I think, in ways that are very instructive. And one of the things that I most appreciate about her is that she knows that her show is incredibly popular in red states, red counties, but she's not afraid to express her political opinion with honesty and gusto. So, yeah.
I also like the idea that she, like, went and found, well, I can't believe I'm crediting CAA for this, but they put together a deck that told her that her face is seen all over the world, and it represents $3 billion in revenue.
Yeah.
And I mean, that's right there.
There's something so interesting about her reps not pushing her to try to go somewhere else and really saying, like, this is the cash cow, let's milk it hard. Because the narrative always before has been, you know, the Shelley Long story of, you're so successful, let's take you somewhere else. And it really is a...
I mean, it worked for a little bit. It worked for a little bit, like Outrageous Fortune.
Like, did you see Monique's video where she talked about how much Netflix had to offer
her? Yeah. I mean, there's been so much conversation about this in all of the arenas of...
Yeah, there's this real...
And Wanda Sykes also responding. Yeah.
But then today, she actually did the math and, like, showed receipts. And, look, I don't like Monique. Monique was, I have it on personal knowledge, how awful she was during the entire Oscar run for Precious. But... Once this recent video that she put out, which we're taping on Monday, and it was like a couple of hours ago, she's not wrong. Like, she made a movie that cost $17 million and it earned $42 million in the box office on 1,000 less screens versus Snatched, which cost $45 and made $42.
Well, I mean, a fucking hour of Monique material. Any of us would love to watch it.
Right.
Because she's never been anything but super funny when it comes to stand-up.
Right.
And Wanda Sykes, like, who apparently was offered less than half of that, like, I want to see her more than any of these people that we're talking about.
Exactly.
And the special that it ended up being, What Happened to Ms. Sykes, is, like, such a great special. And when you think about, you know, what they got for $20 million from Dave
and
Chappelle.
What they're sacrificing, exactly. Let's get to that point. Like I said last week, those two specials weren't that great. They weren't worth what I would have paid for it. They were good. They weren't amazing. I just don't understand, like, what this is going to do to them now in terms of work, because now Netflix is, like I said last week, number one in, like, getting these comedy specials out there, surpassing HBO in that space. Now, have they shot themselves in the foot?
Well, they're also just producing a lot of material. Right. When are What Are You All About?
Cat Williams Netflix special, Great America. The reason why I like this special is because, you know, he's been, like, problematic. He's had, like, at least a dozen instances where he was scraping with the law, like, in the last 2 years, where you just didn't know when it was going to stop, including fighting with, like, 14-year-old kids in a schoolyard. I didn't know when it was going to end. But now he seems to have his meds regulated. He's smoking, like, quality weed. And it was a really good special. And I like the way, you know, it's hard to do a special that's going to basically mock the state of the country and the president, but do it in a way that it's so funny that it doesn't take away from the comedy, because we've seen people go down this road before, and Amy Schumer got like in so much trouble down in Florida, and everybody is always getting accused of just harping on this in a way that's negative, and he found a way to talk about it. Like, one of my favorite jokes is when he says that Trump is an asshole and he knows it, and you kind of have to respect him for knowing for being a dick.
Yeah.
And then saying that he's, like, dropping bombs or making bomb threats, atomic bomb threats, from a Xbox One controller in the bathroom. I'm not delivering it right at all, but it was just the essence of talking about that, and is in such a way that you're making everybody laugh instead of, like... He just seems to have hit his stride in a way that I've never been able to sort of watch the entirety of a Cat Williams special without being like, he's sweating too much, he's yelling too loud, and I'm a little done right at this point. But it was so good.
I'm sorry. As someone who sweats and yells constantly during stand-up, I must disagree. Winter, your current stand-up binge created my All About This week. So you, a couple of weeks ago, tweeted about some Christian comic who you had watched on Netflix.
I love that you watch my Twitter feed, because you don't often engage with it. But I'm glad that I penetrated you.
No, my eyes are always open. What was that woman's name?
Oh, gosh. She really upset me.
Why did she upset you? I forget.
She was, oh, God. She upset me because I was so into the faith-based Christian.
Yeah.
I'm just a mom, wife, you know. And then she was talking about how she lost her kids and her kids don't speak to her. And then her husband died. And then
this was
her,
a comedy special?
It was a faith-based one. So it was like it was like a really long Olympics intro to somebody's skating program. And then I was really into it. It was produced perfectly.
Yeah.
I was locked in. I felt bad. I was excited. I was empowered. I was like, I want to start being this woman. And then 30 minutes in, she's putting on a long dress. And next thing you know, she's walking out on the stage at Trump's inauguration. And I literally was like, click.
Okay. So the thing is that I went to go look at this person to see what her deal was. Yes. I didn't really care for it. But then YouTube was like, you might also want to watch. And I clicked on one of those. And I discovered Jeannie Robertson, who is also a Christian comedian. Well, she specifically bills herself as 6'2" humorous speaker Jeannie Robertson.
They won't call themselves a comedian.
She is. Well, what's the thing
Wait,
is
that's fascinating. She's humorous. What?
Humorous speaker.
Humorous speaker. She's a former Miss North Carolina and was Miss Congeniality at Miss America 1973. And she's a locked tight comedian. She's an astounding, like, I posted it and so many people I know watched it thinking that they were supposed to watch something ironically and then came back and were like, she's really good. And what's stunning about it is that it is this world of stand-up comedy that has grown up completely outside of like the exigencies of like television and stuff. I mean, it is all super, super clean, but this woman, every fucking one of her bits is 8 minutes long.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everything is 8 minutes long, but it is worth it. It is, like, the craft and technique that goes into these stories, like, as somebody who does rely on harsh words and blowjobs and pop culture references, watching somebody just tell a story about...
Shonda Pierce.
That is the woman who I don't like. Jeannie Robertson is the woman I like. Watching her tell a story about her husband going to the store that really is just...
I knew it was going to have something to do with groceries. Like, I knew that deep down inside. No, like, it was going to be about snacks or...
And, like,
the Piggly Wiggly.
Yeah.
The thing is that it's giving you all... Like, one thing that's really interesting is seeing the traditions that she participates in and doesn't participate in. Like, she... her only pop culture references are to the Andy Griffith Show. And she calls her husband Left Brain in a very sort of like Phyllis Diller calling her husband Fang kind of way. And so much of this should put me off as sort of like a woman knowing her place and not being controversial or challenging. But I think watching somebody so skillfully do the work inside of the lines was a really interesting response to me and what I think stand-up comedy can be. And I have to tell you, I watched... And the thing is that this is stand-up comedy that is structured to be presented to you at 1 p.m. after church is over.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And watching it be so good, like, forced me to re-examine the way that I do what I do.
See what Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask, how popular is she?
Oh, let me tell you, her YouTube channel has hundreds of thousands of followers. This woman, she's 74 now, and I was like, well, maybe she'll have dialed it back. Is doing 1 to 2 shows a week for the remainder of the year, mostly in the South, mostly at churches, but she's coming to Palm Springs, and part of me is just
like into it.
I need to
go. We should all go.
Yeah. I would totally. Well, the thing about...
We're going to have to do a deep dive into
Christian culture. But like Shonda Pierce, you touched on a good point there when she like basically is talking about her husband's ashes going missing. And I didn't think that I would. Did you see that part?
No.
She's like, I lost my husband again. And then I lost him the first time and I lost him again. And it was something I just. That was the part that reeled me in. I was so locked in. I was crying. I had tears. And then as soon. Anyway. I'm glad that I inspired you.
But if you are going to take a look at the works of Jeannie Robertson, may I suggest either never go to Las Vegas without a Baptist.
Very different from leaving Las Vegas.
Getting a pashmina, in parentheses, the style in New York.
Oh, God. Or, talk about scrunchies, too, or no?
Or never send your husband to the supermarket.
Oh,
those are truly...
Wait, those are the names of the videos?
Absolutely.
Like, amazing.
The Pashmina bit.
I can't wait to watch this Pashmina thing.
Will fucking snort and laugh. Like
Where did she get the Pashmina Nordstrom Rack? Oh, Marshalls?
No. She has a stylist from New York who's her friend and who she names repeatedly and is often like in the audience and they'll like cut to her. And that woman was talking to her about a Pashmina and it showed up and it was a shawl.
I knew it.
See, we're laughing. She's good.
No, it's the end of that story is fucking great and you will love it. All right, Margaret, what are you all about?
I've been watching The Chi because I grew up in Chicago and I feel like it's my duty. But also, I really love Lena Waithe. In fact, she's my favorite part of Master of None. Won't even talk about the other person that is in Master of None that's been in the news quite a bit lately. But Lena Waithe won a Emmy for her comedy screenwriting for the Thanksgiving episode, so I wondered what she would do with The Chi, which is her own creation for Showtime. And basically it takes place in the south side of Chicago, and it involves a long and complicated chain of people who are all connected by a few different murders. And so far for me, what's holding it together is the performances. Like, she got a stellar cast, including Jason Mitchell from... A lot of you will know him as Eazy-E in Straight Outta Compton. Mm-hmm. And he's really the anchor of the show, is like a guy who got out of the South Side, became a line chef at a fancy restaurant, but still has to basically keep his mother on track, who's a drinker and a tortured soul. And there's a murder in his family, and that also kind of ricochets out for him, and he's struggling to figure out how to resolve it for himself. Mm-hmm. So between the acting and the incredible just dedication to these lives that don't get a lot of screen time ever, it's worth watching. The critique that I have about it is so far, like, structurally, it's a bit loosey-goosey and earnest in a way. Watching the assassination of Gianni Versace, which we'll get into, really made me think, oh, she needs to, like, study some structure a little bit more. But it's definitely worth tuning in. And one performance, too, that I want to call attention to is Detective Rick Cruz, who's played by Armando Riesco. And he's really good and really drawing me in.
The economics of making television these days produces writers' rooms that are less experienced and smaller. Mm-hmm. And it's one of the things we're getting. And there are ways where it feels neat that TV isn't being like it used to be. Mm-hmm. But also sometimes I would just like people to understand structure.
It's
important.
The way we watch television when we were, like, in 1984 compared to 1994 compared to 2004 compared to now, I feel like those were worlds apart from, like, the people who literally were brought up in a system. Like, the system is upending itself.
Oh, yeah. I mean, the system is upending itself for good and for ill.
Right.
And, I don't know. I watch One Day at a Time, and I'm like, that, like...
The new one?
Yeah, and it's just, it's all tightness all the time. And as you said, with these Ryan Murphy operations, look at American Horror Story, which is a shit show,
yeah,
versus these American Crime Stories, which are tight.
But there's going to be a part where this is going to, I mean, I feel like he's been pulled back by somebody. Maybe it was the studio head, because
he ain't in control of these.
He ain't really in control of these, because remember they were supposed to have Katrina this year instead of Versace, and there was a reason somebody...
Let's do the break and then actually talk about this show.
I'm just giving you a teaser.
All right. you got your teaser. You're listening to Pop Rocket. You're going to get the rest of it when we come right back to talk about the assassination of Gianni Versace after this. You guys can spend less time planning your next trip and more time relaxing with Tripping.com. Tripping.com is trusted by millions of travelers and featured in the New York Times, Travel and Leisure, Forbes, and many more. Whether you're looking for a cabin or a beachfront home to get away to this winter, Tripping.com can help you find the perfect place to stay. With Tripping.com, one search lets you filter, compare, and sort over 10 million available properties on trusted sites like VRBO, TripAdvisor, Booking.com, and more. Don't worry if you're getting the best deal. You'll save an average of 18% per night by booking your vacation with Tripping.com. So don't forget, if you want to save time and money while booking the perfect vacation rental for your next trip, head to Tripping.com/rocket today. That's TRIPPING.com/rocket.
Hey everyone, Freddie Wong,
Matt Arnold,
and Will Campos,
here to tell you about Story Break, a writer's room podcast where every week we, the Hollywood geniuses behind Video Game High School, have 1 hour to turn a humble idea into an awesome movie.
Thrill as we weave the tragic tale of Jar Jar, a Star Wars story.
We're going to double down on everything that made the prequels great. Jar Jar, Trade Federation, politics.
Gasp as we assemble a pantheon of heroes for the Kellogg Cinematic Universe.
We could get rid of Snap, Crackle, Pop. I wouldn't even miss them.
You're crazy.
They die in the second act.
Oh, come on!
And join us as we make fun of Matt as he struggles to name a single Beyonce song.
Well, yeah, put a finger on it. Sure, she wants to be Beyonce.
Put a finger on it. Beyonce's famous song.
Will we break the story?
Or will the story break us?
Find out by joining us in the writer's room every Thursday on MaximumFun.org or wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Pop Rocket. I am your host, Donatella Versace. With me in the studio are...
Oh, Tommy Wiseau.
I'm Vinther Mitchell. What was that supposed to be?
It was, I was doing Penelope Cruz.
Well, what was I am doing? Am I Russian?
Yeah, I feel like you guys all sound like Dracula the 20th.
Yes, Vinther Mitchell.
I'm Margaret Wappler.
I'm not going, also not going there.
I have a platinum wig on, okay?
And I'm Karen Thompson.
Oh, that's perfect. Perfect.
Okay, so the second season of Ryan Murphy Productions' American Crime Story has come out, and it is all about the assassination of Gianni Versace by Andrew Cunanan, everybody's favorite pathological liar, gay sex chameleon. It's, what were your reactions to this first episode?
I was so excited because I missed Ryan Murphy in a hot, sweaty, gay-ish or fully gay environment, you know, because Nip Tuck was filmed in Miami, and I think that is just where he sings.
Yeah.
When he's in a space where he can play around with gender construct and sexuality and have like this fashion and all this like vitality, like I think he really can make it sing. And I was really excited from the moment the camera went up. I was enthralled.
Karen, how excited are you to have a half Filipino actor right there and ready to go for the half Filipino role of a lifetime?
Well, you know, it seems like Darren Criss actually had been lobbying with Ryan Murphy for a long time to
really
get this role. Like, you know, back when they were doing Glee, he was kind of harassing him about because he'd sort of heard he was interested in doing something with the Versace story. And he's like, well, you know, Cunanan is like, you know, half Filipino and so am I. And then it just so happened that, you know, to coincide with him aging into the proper moment to be playing this role. One of the things that I wanted to bring up right away is that, you know, just as a memory of this event when it happened, is that how perplexed the rest of the nation and the world seemed about who this killer was and, you know, what ethnicity was, how chameleonic he was. But the minute I heard his name and saw his name,
yeah,
I was like, dude's Pinoy, man.
The idea of Andrew Cunanan as chameleon is so funny to me because it really is people not understanding half Filipino-ness and not understanding gayness and sort of like they show these photos and it's like, yeah, sometimes his hair is up because he's going out and yeah, sometimes his
he
hair
has
is
glasses, sometimes yeah, they're off.
But and it's like if his hair isn't gayed and he's wearing glasses, it's like, look, it's an Asian nerd. And then he turns into a sex machine. And the thing is like the first season of American Crime Story was so interesting because there were so many issues of race and gender that we were dealing with the process of the law. In this one, there's so much that we don't know. There's so much that is speculative, but I was really surprised. Like, I hadn't thought about the extent to which it would give us these big questions about race and like sexuality and, mm-hmm. and gayness specifically.
Yeah. I mean, and in particular where like that touching point between like Filipino-ness and gayness, where
yes.
the sense that both are really forged on this notion that Filipinos are good at imitating things, gays are good at imitating
yeah.
things. They are absorptive of these other cultures and other ways. And then they have the capacity to flip them around and turn them around into something sinister, which I'm still interested in seeing, you know, how he's going to work his way through that, especially the more we have revealed about Cunanan's background. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I am really intrigued that Imelda Marcos has already made a cameo, at
so
least a
quick.
Verbal cameo.
It was
in
so quick.
The
it
first
was like a bingo
episode.
Card.
Yeah.
Margaret, the first season was such an interesting play of camp, where it was like this like undersold normcore camp. And do you feel like it is a more comfortable overlay for that story or this story, the camp of it all?
Well, there's so much campy about this, and I feel like one of the things that's working very well about the show so far is the blurring of fantasy and reality. The fact that you see Cunanan talking with Versace in this drenched in what are they called? The candles.
Candelabras.
Candelabras, yeah. Drenched in candelabras and, like, chandeliers and, like, the whole, like, opera opulence of it all. And they're talking, and Versace's so interested in everything about him. And, oh, you're going to be a novelist and you're going to be a great man and all of these kinds of things, which is an interesting intersection with what may or may not have happened between them in real life. That's quite disputed, in fact. Like, did they know each other? Did they ever cross paths? Like, you know, Donatelli, of course, totally says, no way. They never knew each other. But then other people say, yeah, they did. They crossed paths at some point. So that's something I'm finding really fascinating about it. And I feel like he's allowed to play with the Versace story in a campy way more than he could with the OJ story. Because, like, all the OJ stories, like, all the facts about OJ, you just cannot mess with.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Like, there's just, like, everybody knows about the glove. And mm-hmm. everybody knows about what happened mm-hmm. in the Bronco chase and everything like that. So there's just no room to play. Whereas he's allowed to play here because the details can be fuzzier. And the story is shrouded in a kind of mystery and like how much did they know each other? How much did they really have in common? Like they're talked about as almost like on opposite ends of the spectrum of like gay success, you know, like one being a sort of miserable gay character and one being like proudly gay and making that into his story and into his clothes and everything about him.
Well, it's such an interesting time to be exploring this story because we're talking so much about disparity in power relationships and romantic relationships. And like at the time, it was just sort of like this pathetic wannabe murdered the guy who had the life that he wanted.
Mm-hmm.
But really, what was shown in some of those scenes is what I'm much more familiar with when it comes to gay on gay.
Please talk about it. I want to hear this.
Basically, the thing is that like some of your A-list directors that people will talk about as being exploitative in a people who are not adults way, I have never seen that happen. But what I have seen is them take a 22 or 23-year-old, a legal adult, take him on private jets and show him a magical world for the 6 weeks that he satisfies their needs, and then saying goodbye, young one, and getting a new model.
Right.
And a lot of those people are my friends and like some of them who it happened to 20 years ago and some of whom it happened to like 2 years ago. And that sort of like strange, ambiguous longing for that life they got a taste of and never got to go back
mm-hmm.
to is so interesting in this movie because it all ends up in a dude getting shot.
Yeah.
It's that Hellenistic model of homosexual mentorship.
Yeah.
But one of the things I did want to add, I guess in relation to what you're saying and to something that Margaret was saying about the capacity that you know, Ryan Murphy has to be able to play fast and loose with these details is for those of you who don't know, the Cunanan FBI files are all available online. There are hundreds and hundreds of pages. And actually, when you dive into all of these as told to accounts and witness accounts of how Cunanan moved through the world, you know, from having been a thrifty manager, a manager at Thrifties in Rancho Bernardo,
oh,
yeah,
Rancho Bernardo.
And to, you know, then moving in rather facile ways through these other kind of more glamorous circles, right? You get a sense of how so many people that he was around believed in the mythos that he was able to craft around himself as well. And that's so much of what coming into gayness is about in many respects, at least for me generationally. I remember, like, there was this idea that you had to craft or create some sort of mythos.
Because you're worthless
yourself.
If not.
Yeah.
If you're just, like, a schmo and you're gay, what have you got? So you need to be some sort of weird elf if you're going
to
matter.
Yeah, you need to be remarkable. You don't, you know, you have to have some story about, like, you know, some renegade pirate father or something like that.
But I feel like, with the O.J. story, we were so rooted in facts that it, like, we had wonderful play from Sterling K. Brown and Sarah Paulson, but, like, we were able to craft it around the things that we knew. Mm-hmm. And this puts so much responsibility on little Darren Criss to be able to hold together what this crazy is. And from the first episode, I did get a little scared that we're just going to have frenetic yelling and then like affected telling of lies and
let me say something.
That's what I'm here for.
The thing that I find interesting is that San Francisco, especially at that time, this was pre-ish internet or tech boom. It was a place that you can easily put on a persona and impress people. So you could come in there and it had to be about money because nobody really cared about fame. If you could walk through the streets of San Francisco and be famous, nobody would really bother you, kind of like New York, but they were impressed by you. And that's what would impress people, is sort of like your access to that wealth. So the fact that he would be able to know he could hang out with Versace and say the right things, and then, you know, it reminds me of how, like, J. Paul Getty lived off of Fell right near a corner in a huge big this flat that he lived in is probably now worth $4 or $5 million, but he was literally near right around the corner from the projects and right near a liquor store. But it was the one that was kidnapped.
Yeah.
And all of these people, I feel like I can't speak on it, but just from my observation, if you were a young, sexy, homosexual man and you were in San Francisco, you had a community that protected you because it was a community that really protected each other. So even when I would hear about the aftermath of him being revealed, I would hear little stories about people who knew him, but never thought anything more about him other than just being, like, you know, a fancy gay boy.
One of the things that's so interesting to me is it's the place of the Andrew Cunanan story in the history of HIV in America and the role that it played in his story. It's like just at that point when the cocktails got good enough, that gay people started being sexy again instead of just being a story of sadness. Mm-hmm. And then the way that America was so ready to overlay a story of like HIV sadness over him and then being like, oh no, he's just crazy.
Well, I mean, we should bring up that when this murder happened, that was one of the speculations about his motives, is that he went around killing, because Versace was his fifth victim, and he went around killing people that supposedly had given him possibly HIV. That was one of the speculations.
Yeah.
And I remember hearing about that as a kid. And for one thing, this story stood out to me when it happened, because it was like the first time I was aware of, like, a gay serial killer.
Yeah.
Like, I think I always have thought of serial killers as being hetero and preying on women. And this was, like, a different kind of story.
They're baby boomers and probably brunettes.
Yeah. I think that the phrase impressive that Winter was using and talking about, you know, like, and that's the phrase that was a line of dialogue also in the first episode. He's just like, I just want to look impressive.
Yeah.
You know? I sort of wanted to loop that back and that kind of class aspirationalism to the Filipino dimensions of Cunanan as well. And, you know, and how that all gets covered over by the prevailing narrative of, like, the disturbed homosexual.
Yeah.
Right. And that is, you know, that there's so much immigrant dream stuff that's happening here. I mean, his own father certainly, you know, had certain issues with that and tried to, like, get rich quick, being arrested for embezzlement. Mm-hmm. And that sort of aspirationalism, that kind of immigrant aspirationalism, tied up to a particular relationship that I think that Filipino cultures have to stardom and to notoriety and to sort of being known and understood in an American context. It's such a kind of post-colonial mentality. But I think that that very much also feeds into all of the things that we see, you know, Cunanan struggling with. It's very much bound up and overlaps with a lot of those things around his gayness. But I think so much of this is also driven by those forms of alienation that come from his racialization.
Well, there's something so interesting about the colonized status when it comes to Filipino-ness and gayness, of just sort of like, all of your culture I have access to. Mm-hmm. Like the Filipinos since 1900 have sort of had vast access to our culture, and like English is in their world and in their mm-hmm. lives. And so when you're here, you're able to talk all of the talk and play all of the game, but you have access to this other world, which is sort of interestingly similar to being a gay man or a gay generally. But also the thing of mixed Filipino status as a Cheshire Cat mm-hmm. minority, like so many of our celebrities who are just read as white are like have a Filipino parent. And there's something so interesting in America about like the ability to sort of like just pass. I so love embracing a young, somewhat attractive gay man, leveraging it as hard as he can. And there is just this relationship to self as commodity that only a gay boy can do. Speaking of psychos, Penelope's performance, good performance or best performance?
I mean, you know, I was thinking a lot about Maya Rudolph's Donatella on SNL, which was also, I thought, pretty hilarious and pretty good. And I thought that this was just a shade more realist than that.
But barely. I was really impressed by, like, what a swing she takes with it. Mm-hmm. And it was an important reminder that this girl started out working with Almodovar and, like, is not, you know, she understands how ridiculous works.
Yeah, I mean, she walks up to the bell and then she slams on the bell. Like, there's no holding back in that performance. And I thought it was wonderful.
Well, and she
the accent and, like, the fact that she just sounds like she always has, like, a little metal plate in her mouth or something.
She apparently asked because she's friends with Donatella, right? So apparently she had a really serious conversation with her about, you know, playing this role and, you know, I just, you know, want to know about your feelings. And then she's like, I'm going to swing for the fences. Get ready.
So, yeah, Donatella is not a fan of this. She doesn't mm-hmm. want this production to go ahead. I mean, from everything I read, like, she was friendly to it at first, but now pretty much disowns it and says this should be treated as a work of fiction. Which taps back into the rumors that always swirled around this case, particularly around HIV. Like, did he have it? Did he not, Versace? And, you know, we should talk about Maureen Orth's book called Vulgar Favors. And in that book, Maureen Orth asserts that he did, based off of, like, a police detective.
Oh, really?
Yeah, saying that the
pills that he takes.
You're right.
And they allude to it in the show.
In the first episode, we do see some allusions. And the moment where she's talking, where Donatella's talking to Ricky Martin, and she says, what are they going to find out? You're supposed to have taken care of him. And he says they're going to find out everything.
I mean, the tension of that relationship. I also like that you said when Donatella was talking to Ricky Martin. Which
he just can't disappear in my mind. But I thought he was great, actually.
No, here's the thing I love about Ricky Martin's performance.
Yeah.
Is when Gianni Versace is dead and bleeding on the ground.
Yeah.
Ricky Martin, in tennis whites, looks at him. And attempts to give you his best soap opera crying instead of doing what Ricky Martin or any gay guy would have done at that moment, which is shriek. Like, and any real actor, if Sarah Paulson had been cast as the gay lover, like, she would have given you this one moment of just sort of, like, open shriek. And the fact that, like, Ricky Martin is giving you protective, defensive, mask homosexuality at all times is just the cutest. Like, I want to pinch his little cheek and say, like, oh, you can't stop telling this lie, can you?
Even the location.
Beautiful tennis shorts.
The location of the murder was just like, it's so weird to know that someone lived literally on Ocean Ave on South Beach on a corner mansion and got shot in the face in front of their house. And everybody was just like, there was nobody out there because everybody in Miami wakes up at noon. And I was just like, this is like, how did no one see this?
The weird role of people standing around and kind like the people asking for autographs or the people being like, that's Gianni Versace.
Yes!
Was pretty great. I also like the Versace underwear waistband.
Yes. Showing
up.
And the flip-flops.
Yes, like just really sort of emphasizing the important but hoary place that this guy had in like sexy gay male culture.
There was a part of me that didn't want to tune into this because there is something about Versace that has whiffs of Trump to me.
Okay, tell me about that.
And I didn't want... Okay, so Trump and Versace are aligned in the sense that they both are very attracted to, like, American mythos and big opulence and money and glamour and wealth. And, you know, for God's sakes, Gianni Versace's ashes were kept in a 14-karat gold box. And I didn't want to see the celebration of it, in a sense, now, because there's something about that, like, rank, gross, glamorous capitalism that's just not sitting with me well right now.
I feel like the show does such a great job of giving you tastes of Gianni Versace's origins and what he did with himself to make you understand, like, he is Andrew Cunanan, just with slightly better brain chemistry. Only slightly better brain chemistry.
Yeah.
That he was this sort of, like, grasping creature who was always trying to show... who put his ashes in a 14-karat gold box.
Yeah, I mean, it ended up, like, once I was watching it, I lost that feeling about it. Like, I remembered the things about Versace that actually are very... worth investigating and worth thinking about that don't align with Trump.
It's the hum of Baroque.
Yes.
I mean, that's what it is. Like,
and the
that
fact
kind
that he
of
actually
optimism.
Has talent.
Yeah, the hum of Baroque, the act of, you know, like, I mean, we have to remember that there's a way in which, you know, Trump has even just even stolen that, right?
Yeah,
like,
that's
kind
true.
Of stolen that level of opulence and decadence.
Yeah, he's made it into a dirty thing.
From like, yeah, from like a whole culture, from centuries of aesthetes and those who would be deemed, you know, aberrant and awful because of these things.
Yeah, whereas, you know, back then I think I could completely enjoy it.
Yeah,
but now it's tainted a bit for me.
Was anybody else just sort of like floored by Kathy Moriarty just showing up?
Yes, as the hotel clerk.
Yes, and it was just one of those moments of like, is Kathy Moriarty okay? Do we need to put together a Kickstarter? Because the fact that she's available to do this... and we're not seeing her in more stuff because we'd all love to see Kathy Moriarty all the time. I need to know what's going on.
I think this is the fate of like a 65-plus-year-old actress,
yeah,
basically. But the other thing I worried about with this show, and I'm still deciding, obviously we've only seen one episode, is like where the humanity is going to be.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because that was something that troubled me about Feud, is at times I felt like he takes Betty and Joan's life and just... shows the most miserable aspects of it and basically is another, it's like he critiques how the machine used them and ate them up and spat them out, but then he's another iteration of the machine using them and spitting them out. Mm-hmm. And so I'm wondering how that's going to play into this, like if he's going to have any kind of real sensitivity and compassion, which I feel like is not Ryan Murphy's strong points.
Well, and also with Andrew Cunanan not interesting. Like, it's so much more interesting to mythologize him and make it bigger. It is interesting. We have so many pieces of Gianni Versace's domestic life that it will be interesting to see how much sort of like what his life was like in the flashbacks.
One of the safe moves of doing this and with a character like Cunanan is that it's somebody who can't be redeemed. It's like, and I don't know that there's anybody who can be redeemed in this framework or in this context or in this story. So it's like sentiment, true feeling. I'm not sure where it can land because I'm not sure that there's a person with whom it should land.
From the Facebook page, Aaron D. Van Sysok said, we're currently experiencing a renewed interest in serial killers, something akin to the 90s. Our movies, television shows about the Dahmers, Bundys, Mansons, and Cunanans of the world cashing in on the loss and pain of families affected by their killings. which I think is sort of the point you're making. Like, you're saying it's more about exploring the way that we scandalize these
yes.
things.
Think about it. We didn't have internet yet. We kind of did, but we didn't really.
Yeah.
We still depended on reading magazines, newspapers, and hearsay. The fact that this guy runs, like, with his life dependent on it, to his car to get his camera to take a Polaroid so he can sell it. He immediately, like, you didn't see that in OJ. You didn't see that. Nobody could even think about that. They were so busy trying to...
Oh, that's
to
a great point. Yeah. That's the evolution over
the
those 3 years.
The evolution over the 3 years. They were like, oh, my God, I know I can get... He literally said, what is his opening bid? Like $60,000.
It was like $30,000.
$30,000.
Yeah.
Although no one bought it.
No, at least not then. Yeah. But Ryan Murphy, I do think, is very interested in figuring out, like, when did we decide to make these kinds of murders a mass media event and a spectacle and something that is an eBay bidding war, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, and Andrew Cunanan is a person who's motivated by that to some extent. Mm-hmm. Like,
yes. He wants to be
acquiring
in the
acquiring
fancy...
his clippings.
Yeah.
Yes. He wants to be in the fancy magazines that he buys.
Can I tell you guys the saddest thing in the way that we all sort of like researched after this to figure out what was real and what was not? Mm-hmm. The saddest thing to me was finding out the way that Donatella truly, deeply fucked over the Ricky Martin guy, like, because there basically weren't protections for gay partners at that point.
So that's why I think that why she's mad is because I bet you he started talking and gave them lots of info. Mm.
Yeah. Dan Ben Tzvi says from the Facebook group, the awkwardness of watching this play out on TV when you lived through it the first time. Versace Mansion is 10 minutes from my house, and this all feels a little icky and exploitative to me. I mean, Feud, both seasons of American Crime Story really have been, I mean, they are mucking through people's lives, and they are playing it to some extent for laughs. Are we bad people for enjoying that?
Well, that's what I was trying to get at, that I always have an issue letting go and just being entertained. In a way, I don't want to ever forget my humanity when I'm watching something. And I feel like at times I completely forget my humanity and that these are real people. And I have to, like, periodically remind myself and say, wait a minute, this actually is someone's pain. This is someone's real blood. And that's a very uncomfortable push-pull about it. And I'm not saying that he shouldn't make any of these series. He should. And he's so smart and stylish, and he gets at real truths about the situations and the people that it saves it just enough for me, but barely.
I feel like there is something very deep to gay culture. And Karen, stop me if I'm wrong. But there, so much of gay culture in a very deep way is about... tossing popcorn into your mouth while you watch the tragedy of regular life play out in front of you. That to some extent, like, when it comes to media, it's so frequently around straight people, and it's so much just like, ha ha ha, these are their stupid problems. And it's a way of, like, both processing your very real and visceral problems, but also, like, feeling distance towards it. And it's interesting doing it with Andrew Cunanan, because there is also that way that the skill that gay men particularly develop, we start applying to each other. And it's the origin of cattiness, is this sort of like feeling deeply victimized and like just approaching the world like through Schadenfreude.
Yeah.
Thoughts?
Victimized, scrutinized, and then, you know, rising from the ashes and figure out a way, like, to convert that those moments of shame and humiliation into something that's really constitutive of who you are and yourself, sometimes for the better, sometimes for much, much worse. But I would say that actually one of the reasons that I think, you know, it isn't just the kind of spectacularization of, or, like, of these events or revisiting these events in order to, like, you know, be prurient in any way, but I think that it is precisely those ham-fisted moments of, like, here's the guy selling the Polaroid, here's Cunanan cutting up, you know, articles from the New York and LA Times about his murders. It's trying to teach us something. There is a didactic element to it, and the effort that it's making is in understanding or figuring out how to frame these relatively recent events in the broader narrative of our culture mm-hmm. and how we end up where we are. Mm-hmm. And so I do think that, you know, it's not like we're just getting these details for the sake of reveling in these details, but, you know, as the ham-fisted symbolism of the first episode lets us know, it's about really kind of walking us through the different people, the different lifestyles and racial identities and ways of inhabiting this world that end up, you know, having to wash themselves out into how we cope with being, surviving in a hyper-mediatized age now where the minute something happens, we, you know,
we need
can
to
document
everything.
It. We know how to do it. Yeah, exactly. We can capture it. So,
an interesting thing about the American Crime Story is trying to sort of like pinpoint the things that will serve recurring roles. Like the mm-hmm. selling of the Polaroid is the moment at Chin Chin when the Kardashians get excited
yeah.
that their dad gets a table because he's famous. And we don't, in the first episode, we weren't presented with those sort of like emotional rocks that were Sarah Paulson and Sterling K. Brown. And it sort of seemed like the police officer, who I think is from Orange is the New Black,
yes,
mm-hmm. was maybe going to be that. But it's like, when it's somebody like that who isn't famous like Marsha Clark was, are we going to go home with this person? How are we going to see their life, you know?
How are we going to process people processing the homosexuality in
yeah.
this story? I mean, that's also part of it as well, is like seeing how people can't quite process or wrap their minds around how gay lives are lived in 1997,
right? That was the scene with the police officers, like, legitimately not being able to understand a committed
that
relationship.
Yeah.
That was open?
Yeah.
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 Yeah. I do think that the series is supposed to anchor on Andrew Cannon, which is an interesting problem in a sense, because
yeah.
that puts us almost
he's an unreliable narrator.
Well, even more so, he's not very I don't find him very sympathetic in
yeah.
a way. It's like watching a Christian Bale in American Psycho or something.
Mm-hmm.
He's like, to me, a very similar character where he embodies all of these sort of like American psychoses and problems, and that's an interesting idea but not a sympathetic character.
Yeah.
Whereas I feel like Marsha Clark, yeah, I could feel what she was going through and be rooting for her in a sense. And like, who are we going to root for in this story? I'm wondering about that. Is it Donatella? That's what it seems like so far.
Ricky Martin.
I just hope Darren Criss brings Andrew Cannon to the Emmy.
Oh, don't. Are you trying that out here?
He's dead, though.
Yeah, he's very dead.
But you know, but what did I want to say?
I know. I just meant like an urn.
No, but I mean, I think I'm interested in seeing where the class critique goes, though, because I think that's what this
class
is ultimately going to land
mm-hmm.
on. This, you know, in addition to the media critique, it's going to be about the class shit, because it is going to be about how Cunanan is like, you know, a broke aspirational motherfucker who, like, you know, it's going to dive into the Versaces and their class histories. It's going to like point out all of the things that happens, all the people who you mow over on your way to like chasing that, you know, gold plated fucking urn or
yeah.
whatever it is.
It's like a gay Catch Me If You Can also mixed with Monster.
Mm. Mm. So
listen, he went, oh
no,
come
it was
on.
A good summation, Winter.
No, it wasn't. You didn't
know. I thought it was interesting. I had to think about
it. That's a process.
I didn't turn that one over.
Please keep watching American Crime Story. Tell us what you think of it.
You should also tell us what you think he should tackle next. Because I, for one, I just don't want to see Katrina next season.
I know. What will be fun?
Night Stalker.
Mm-hmm.
No, I mean, what? Like, in I just don't understand anything that will be campy or good about fucking Kathleen Blanco. You're listening to Pop Rocket. We're gonna be right back after this.
I love Forget Me Nots.
I'm Jesse.
I'm Jordan.
And we've been doing Jordan Jesse Go for almost 10 years now.
And it's not gotten any easier to describe.
So we asked our fans to do it for us.
Jordan Jesse Go is a weekly conversation with
two best pals,
two hilarious friends,
the hilarious smart kids,
talking about hilarious stuff that happens to them,
mostly really stupid stuff,
awkward anecdotes, insane tangents, heartfelt stuff.
It's like being thrown in the middle of a hilarious conversation between you and your best pals.
It's a show that makes me laugh every week, which is pretty rare and wonderful.
It might be the best thing on the internet.
One of the funniest things you will hear.
And it's the best part of my week
and has kept me company for the past 7 years through all sorts of life. I love those guys.
That's Jordan Jesse Go, the comedy podcast that's been named Best of iTunes.
Every Monday on MaximumFun.org or your favorite podcasting software.
I'll hug you and kiss you and love you.
Love you.
Love you. Love you.
Welcome back to Pop Rock. I'm your host, Guy Branum. With me in the studio are
Winter Mitchell,
Margaret Wappler,
and Karen Thompson.
Every week on Pop Rock, we ask our panel, what's your current jam? Margaret Wappler, I'm going to ask you a question. Okay.
Yeah.
Are you ready for it?
I am.
Margaret, what is your current jam?
My current jam is from the Mountain Goats, who is John Darnielle. And this is his 16th album,
my
which
God.
Is amazing to think about. Hats off just for doing that alone. This is an album called Goths. It is all centered around goths, but wrapped also in his ideas about Christianity and what darkness and lightness means. And this is one of my favorite songs off of the album called Wear Black.
Check me out, I'm young and ravishing.
I also played that for Donatella, who could wear black like nobody's
yeah.
business.
It doesn't sound very Mountain Goaty, or to me, because I'm much more familiar with the more, you know, the punkier, or like
yeah.
the kind of. Although I would say, I
you're right. It's a departure. The backup singers.
Yeah, it's almost like John Darnielle is doing an Elvis Costello move.
Yeah,
you know, a little bit later in his career.
No, it's true. I think at this point he's morphed all around. I mean, the man wrote a novel recently and got nominated for a National Book Award for it. It seems like he's pretty good at switching tracks.
I don't know who this person is, but neat.
Look him up. Google him.
Winter, you're literally wearing black.
Yes, I always wear black.
What's your jam? You don't always wear black.
No,
sometimes
you're probably right.
You have fun rompers.
Sometimes. God, miss that era.
Yeah, where are your rompers, girl?
Girl, I can barely fit in them. Anyway, that's a whole other story.
I
want to talk about this song that I just realized is the original. It contains a portion of it that was sampled by Basement Jacks for Where's Your Head At, which is an amazing song.
Yep.
Also,
wow, I haven't thought about Basement Jacks in a while.
I think about them all the time because I've been thinking about my youth a lot.
Yeah.
And I've been thinking about how much I love dancing to these songs and getting real high. And I didn't realize.
that's the youth.
That's the youth. And M.E. is a song by Gary Numan, whom I only ever heard Cars from. And when I heard this, it came up on my Spotify Discover. Y'all should start paying me. I was like, oh, this is where that sample came from. So here's Emmy by Gary Numan. Good song.
I like that.
Yeah, I knew
it. Karen Thompson, what is your jam?
For some reason, this song popped into my head again when I was deliriously feverish over the last couple of days, and it made me feel better. And maybe it's because it's called "Feels So Good," and it's by Chuck Mangione, the world's most famous flugelhornist ever. So here we go with "Feel So Good."
Here it is.
so smooth.
Oh, man.
I like that is crazy.
We didn't even get to the next part,
I know,
though.
The
we,
best
need to, like,
part.
We gotta yeah, bump we need this
to,
shit up.
We need to. No. Bump, 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 bump.
Yeah. Oh, and then it just goes off the rails here. Yeah. Anyway, it keeps going on. This song is like the original
version.
This is
the 25-minute version.
This
That's
is
what we
the,
need.
This is from the 9-minute 43-second version.
Also, who's the second most famous flugelhornist
yeah.
ever?
I mean, I would say there was an era there in the 70s. I bet you Maynard Ferguson busted one out, but he was primarily a trumpet player and maybe played the cornet.
Karen, I am tired of your brass American agenda making its way onto this show.
Make America brass again, baby.
Keep your saxophone to yourself.
Do you believe, though, that this song was like number 4 on the Billboard
yes!
Hot 100?
1979.
There's something sexy. Yeah.
There's something so evocative of music that from an era when you were alive as a child, but your parents did not like, because it only shows up to you on television. And so, like, I have such deep memories of this song, but only like
from the Memorex commercial.
Exactly.
Wasn't yeah. it also in? No, it couldn't have
well,
been.
Well, of course, anybody who's watched King of the Hill knows how Luann is obsessed with Chuck Mangione.
But I feel like, maybe I'm wrong, but wasn't this like the music they would play when, like, on Wheel of Fortune or Price is Right, when they would announce, like, what you can, you're going to get
maybe.
This fabulous.
I think it
put
just
it up
feels
again,
like that.
Christian. It's, put it up, it's, that part. Come on, Christian.
This is thanks for
they'd
playing.
Be like, they'd be like, oh, and then what do we have from Chuck? Oh, we've got a range. And then this beautiful range comes from
that's
19...
So,
and
then
it's
so
on
true.
A, you can get this range. And then here's a 1979 Camaro with four-wheel drive.
You know, unfortunately, I mean, this
sign
is the music that
Barker.
A lot of my family makes, which
so
is this
wonderful.
Kind of jazz fusion Aww. Stuff. So it's a little, you know, but...
I want a Tongson concert.
The smooth.
I'm excited for it to be back. I'm going to use my jam to cheat and talk about a movie.
That's not what this is for.
I did it with Phantom Thread the other
she
day.
She did it with Phantom Thread. So Netflix,
fair game.
Netflix let me know that Sofia Coppola's Marie Antoinette was available to be watched.
Oh,
and I had seen that for the first time in the movie, and I was very excited. And I remember going to it and being like, what the fuck was that? And leaving and being a little bit annoyed. And I rewatched it. And I realized I just had not accepted what Sofia Coppola does, which is take a like 3-centimeter long journey and have somebody get 78% of the way there over the course of the movie. Like, she's somebody who is committed to small, realistic journeys, but she does not use the tools of realism that we expect
yeah.
out of her
yeah.
because it was so splashy and like luminous. And the thing is that I think as time goes on, it will be a movie that I go back to and
yeah.
think about more because of the way it is talking about what it means to be a woman and how much control you actually have over your life. The place that normalcy plays in our lives. There is a simply... She is strong enough to never have this woman say, let them eat cake, because, of course, Marie Antoinette didn't.
But she shows it.
But she fucking shows you a lot of shoes and cake while playing this song.
So sweet you make my mouth water.
You've been listening to Pop Rocket, hosted by me, Guy Branum, with Winter Mitchell, Margaret Wappler, and Karen Tongson. Our theme music is Party Boob Chap by Ozzy Mizo. Thanks to him for letting us use it. Thanks to C-Day Raw, SLP in Texas, AbbaBBB3, and A Settle Down Soda Cracker for the 5-star reviews in Apple Podcasts. If you haven't already, please review us. And I just want to note that the 9 months of time when I was not allowed to make jokes about Margaret's health because for fear of marking the baby, our reviews went down. And ever since things have gone back to that, you guys have been responding. I don't know what this says about America.
I don't either, but you guys should all send me vitamins.
SLP in Texas, or in TX, says, I love Pop Rocket and recommend it to everyone. Guy, Winter, Karen, Margaret, and the revolving cast of Co's are effortlessly articulate, but without a hint of pretension.
Aww.
That's so sweet. No one should ever say I'm without a hint of pretension, though. Or fucking Louis Vertel. Get in touch with us on Twitter. We're at Pop Rocket, or join our Facebook group and join in the discussion. We are a production of MaximumFun.org, and our producer is the squealy Christian Duenas.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.